Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Short Coat Podcast, and I'm your host, Dave Etler. Aline Sanduk, Casey McCleary.
Checking in. Yes.
How are you?
Pretty good.
I don't know if you noticed, but we have guests.
Whoa. We did notice these strangers.
When did they get here?
I know, it's weird. We are joined today by Amy Ahern, the assistant director of admissions. She also manages interview day.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And we're joined by a super secret persona who we will only call Dr. B. She is a clinical assistant professor and a member of our admissions committee. And she's here to reveal the secrets.
All of the secrets.
She's not actually here to reveal any secrets about admissions day or admissions process. And Amy is here to talk about interview day.
Yes.
And the thought here is to just do a little bit of demystification.
We need to at least pretend like they're secrets just to generate viewer excitement.
You think we need
intrigue?
You think we need more buzz on the show?
Dave, we are the media. We need to scandalize.
All right. Consider it done. So I have two goals for the show. One is to sort of, talk about the admissions process and maybe enlighten people to the point where it's not such a mystery. A little bit. And also to demystify the interview process or the interview day and the process behind that.
Sounds good.
That's what Amy's here for. In fact, we'll start with you, Amy. All right. My understanding of the interview process is it's the first step that separates a potentially successful applicant from the rest, right?
Yes.
I mean, is that the goal, right?
It's the goal. I think the goal is to have people come here and people can write wonderful things about what they've done for the last however many years. But the goal in the interview is to talk with the person one-on-one and see what kind of person they are off of paper. And when you think about what kind of physician you want one day, you want one that can relate well to you as a patient. And so that's really why we want to bring people here so we can understand them and get to know them in the ways that they are off of the paper.
Right. So they send in their applications and get things like personal statements. You've got, of mm-hmm. course, transcripts. You've got what else? The
MCAT scores.
Of course, MCAT scores.
Mm-hmm. Letters of recommendation.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a big one.
Is there a pre-screening process before? I mean, does anybody who sends their stuff in get an interview?
No, nope.
I don't think so.
Nope. There is a pre-screening process that would happen for every application. So we receive about 3,200 applications every year. And last year we did 630 interviews. So yes, there is a pre-screening that happens.
During the pre-screening, can you say about what you're looking for?
Yeah. It's definitely a holistic review process at Iowa. And so we look at, of course, grades and MCAT scores. But then we go on and we look at the whole application. We want to read the letters of recommendation carefully. We read personal statements. And then we're looking to see what students have done outside of the classroom as well. So we like to see what they've done related to patients and healthcare experiences, what volunteering activities they've done, were they a member of teams, were they leaders on their campuses, have they shadowed physicians? All of those kinds of things are really important to us when we're reviewing applications.
And for the interview process, is it still true that at Iowa, at least, the interviewers go in without having seen your application beforehand?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a closed file interview at Iowa, and that's different at other schools. Depending on where you are, it's really good to know what kind of interview you're walking into. But yes, the interviewers here at Iowa only know the student's name, major, and where they attended college. And so they've never seen the whole application before, and that's done very intentionally. Mm-hmm.
The MCATs changed. Do you guys know this?
Yeah,
we do.
I think everybody who has any interest in going to med school or ever has had interest knows that the MCAT has changed.
Mm-hmm. I think registration for the MCAT actually decreased this year just because people were like, oh God, what is this new stuff? Well,
are we still in the transition year? I mean, we're still pretty close to that transition from when it changed.
Yeah, this is the transition year now. Right. Yeah, so the test hadn't been revised since 1991. And so this year, 2015, is the first year of the new MCAT. So students have started taking this newly revised test as of April this year.
And it's what, like 2 hours longer than the previous one?
It's a long sucker. So
2.5 hours longer.
They're saying it's 7.5 hours. There are breaks included. There are breaks. So you bring your granola bars and your sandwich. And you do get some breaks throughout the day. But yes, it is a longer test. That is true. The positive to that, though, is that you actually get a little bit more time on some of the sections. So that is a positive change, we hope. But yes, it is a longer test day. That's for
it's
sure.
All positive, Amy.
Oh, yeah. All of it, right?
Yes.
Everything about this process is perfect. Stop doubting.
Are you happy with the changes, do you think?
We'll see. I hope that it is for better.
In principle, I mean, we haven't seen the effects.
Well, that's just it. No. We haven't seen it at all yet. We haven't gone through a full cycle with these new MCAT test scores. And keep in mind, we still have students who are applying that have the old MCAT test scores. So depending on the school, they are deciding what scores they are honoring. At Iowa, we are honoring both old and new scores this year. So it's a really interesting year for applying to medical schools across the country.
Does the new MCAT have the writing sample on it?
It does not.
So we're looking at three different kinds of MCAT scores now, potentially.
Potentially, yeah.
It's been a few years since they made that change.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think the year I took it, I want to say, 2013, I think, they did not have a writing sample, but they did have practice questions for this test. So
okay.
I did the practice. I don't know if Aline did it, but I did the practice section for this one that were like testing the test questions, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they gave me a gift card, so that was cool.
That's very cool.
A gift card to what?
Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
That's one free admission to medical school.
Best gift card ever.
Wow.
Anything but free. I think they're also adding psychology and sociology sections.
Yes.
As part of why it's longer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm one of the few people who actually wishes that they'd gotten to take the new MCAT. Everybody, like, there was a huge flood of people trying to take the old one because they still had all the old study materials and it was very tested and everybody felt like they knew what was going on with it. But I kind of wish that I had been able to, like, put it off a couple years and take the newer one because psychology was my undergrad major and I feel like I would have kicked butt.
You do know you got into med school though, right?
Yeah. Dude, it never stops. But my score could have been higher.
Oh my gosh.
You're here.
People freak me out.
It never stops.
You can still take it just for fun.
No. I have to worry about step one. I'll call that fun. Air quotes.
And that does have sociology and psychology on it.
Yes.
So
you mentioned before that our interview day here at Iowa might not be considered typical at other schools. Do you have a sense of what other schools are doing?
Yeah. You know, I think that schools either follow a format that's similar to ours, or they might do what's called the MMI, so the multiple mini interviews.
Oh, right. We one of our previous co-hosts talked about his mini medical interview.
What did he say?
Well, I can't remember what episode number. I wish I could right now because I would say it. But he was asked given a list of different kinds of people, you know, baker, candlestick maker, all this kind of stuff. Who of these people should be saved, at the end of the world? And one of them was prostitute and policeman and all this kind of stuff. And his answer to this was that, the prostitute was definitely on the list because they might
go forth and reproduce.
Or go forth and reproduce kind of issues.
Wow.
A medical school interview?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Apparently,
he didn't get in.
The interviewer was also attractive, so.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He had a little trouble.
Like, not a good combination.
He had a little trouble maintaining
all kinds of levels of awkward there.
Maintaining his composure as he talked about his doomsday harem. So multiple mini interview is... If you haven't listened, Amy will tell.
Sure. So school will bring probably about 100 or more candidates to one interview day, and they all go through an interview on the same day. Usually they have about 10 minutes at several different stations throughout the day, and they are sometimes charged on their own to keep track of time so that they're moving down the line to the next room and the next question efficiently.
Wait, they have to keep track of their own time?
Sometimes, yes.
Nice.
Yes.
I love it.
And so... we don't do it that way at Iowa. We will bring 16 candidates three times a week from September until January. So the groups are much smaller. The interview itself is 25 minutes with two faculty members. And then all students participate in a case-based learning session with about six or seven applicants. And one of our M4 students will facilitate that session. Mm-hmm. So it's just a different process, but we like the way we do it here at Iowa. We think we find great people as a result of the interviews. So, yes.
I've been meaning to talk to you about
it. Sorry. That was a high five.
Yeah,
that I almost missed.
Just for us to enjoy, listeners. Sorry.
What do you think our interviewers value during the actual interview? I mean,
yeah, I think that they value people that are going into medicine for the right. I just did air quotes too. Reasons. Uh-huh. So if someone is not talking about their motivations for medicine in a way that is perceived as altruistic and a desire to help people, and the person's being genuine in the things that they're saying, I think that's all things that our interviewers are ready to hear about.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is super okay with me, because that is the direction that I want medicine to go. So I'm glad that we are selecting more for people like that than I think we maybe have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Or do you have something you wish to say about our past?
No, I don't know about these past classes. I'm just thinking of the history of medicine in general.
I see. Thank you for clarifying. What do you think students should do to follow up after their interview?
That's a good question. I think different schools handle this in different ways. I think that it's always nice to thank a volunteer for their time. Our interviewers are all volunteers, so they're not a part of the admissions review committee at all. And so some students...
Well, that's something that might not be obvious to interviewers.
Right, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think some students... And think about it. Y'all went on the trail and you interviewed at, 10 different schools? And by the time you're at school number 9, you don't know where you are, what the rules are, or how they handle things.
Right, right. Everybody does it different.
Right. And so students are inclined to send a thank you note, a proper thank you note to their interviewers, which is very nice, knowing that you're thanking them for their time. The decision, your thank you note is not going to impact the decision of the committee whatsoever at that point. But thanking a volunteer for their time is always appreciated and a kind thing to do. But, you know, I've seen some students really get into beautiful stationery and calligraphy and these really eloquent notes, which is very kind.
That's just how they fill out their shopping list.
Right.
Come on.
Which is really kind, but at the same time, the decision isn't going to be impacted by calligraphy and stationery.
It seems like it can't hurt.
Right.
Right. It's a nice gesture, of course, to say thank you. And that is a character trait that you want in future.
This is what my mom always taught me, you know, say thank you note.
Yeah.
Thank you
notes. Yeah. Do you get to read personal statements, Dr. B?
I sure do.
You do? Okay.
Yes.
What sort of personal statements do you enjoy reading?
Well, that's an interesting question. They should be well-written.
Right.
It's ideal if they don't have spelling and grammatical errors, which does occasionally happen. So
sure.
Proofreading is important.
If I was writing it.
Yes.
That
would
happen.
But what I really like to see is somebody who talks about who they are as a person and why medicine is the right career for them. And people come to that decision in very different ways. And it's interesting to hear how people have come to the decision that medicine is the career for them. And it's nice to see how people are altruistic, like Amy mentioned, and want to serve other people. And that's one of the things that I look for in personal statements. Is it like a show don't tell kind of situation?
Absolutely.
Don't just say, I am altruistic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I like people. I am smart. Like, you have to actually describe situations.
Yeah. Tell stories.
Yeah.
Of course.
Think back to your personal statement.
I blocked it out.
Do you think you did well? I mean, obviously you didn't do poorly, but what were you thinking? I guess, what were you thinking when you wrote your personal statement? Was it something along those lines, or was it something different?
It was a really confusing time because everyone had very different advice for how to write it. So some people said to write it more like a resume without bullet points. Like, oh, just tell your story. And one person was like, no, pick something that like what is that moment that really triggered for you? And that was the best piece of advice. And I don't know, you guys can tell me if it's wrong, but the best piece of advice is to figure out what that turning point was where I started to think about medicine, and then what experiences I engaged in along the way that cultivated that interest. And I think that that's the story that I told, you know, in college. I wanted to be a scientist, and I went and became involved in research, and I really enjoyed it, but I wanted to meet the people that the science was helping, and there wasn't enough of that in research. And I had some patient experiences that like really, yeah, just like warms your heart. You know, it's very sad. It's really selfish to enjoy the feeling of helping people. Like, you're helping people, but it also feels good. And, you know, that's kind of what I talked about in my personal statement.
That sounds very, very honest, you know, like honest with yourself, that like sometimes altruism is a little just inherently selfish because it does feel good to do it. Like, you do get something back out of it, and it is for the other person, but like, you can't say that there's not a part of it that's for you too. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, that sounds very
wise.
Well, and I would disagree with the person who instructed you to basically reiterate what's already on your application in the form of a resume.
Yeah.
And the best advice that I can ever tell people about personal statements is the best personal statement is the one that only you can write. There's nobody else on the planet that could write this statement because of the things that you were just talking about. Yeah. You know, think about what Dr. Beebe typically reads in the statements. I like to help people. I'm good at science. Yada, yada. And so that statement that only you can write, what makes you different from the thousands of other people that also think they're going to be an excellent physician? What is that story that only you can tell? And if you write a draft of it and you give it to someone and ask them, am I the only person that could have written this? And if the answer is yes, it's really good.
That's amazing
advice.
That
is really good advice.
That was free.
Nice.
You should charge for that.
The personal statement should let the interview or let the committee know who you are. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. It can be really hard to do because
if they don't like who you are,
you also have to know who you are.
Exactly. That's a good point. We also want you to be a good person.
But, no serial killers,
yeah,
please.
Who are you? And we already know that you're smart and good at science and all of that because we've seen your grades and we've seen your letters of recommendation. But the personal statement, it tells us about you in a way that we don't get to know from anywhere else in your application.
It's extremely vulnerable, and I mean,
it is.
It's sort of a, I don't know, I feel like finding a medical school, and I think this is even more true when you get to residency, but finding a medical school is almost like a courtship process. And as much as everybody would like to game the system just to, you know, get to the end goal, if you do some, like, it's really hard to do. And then even if you did, like, you might be unhappy with where you got to because you weren't actually honest with yourself.
Yeah. You know,
about the process of getting there. It's very, very vulnerable.
I was lurking in the fora at studentdoctor.net. And in them, I saw a lot of pre-med strategizing on how to get into, you know, quote, the best schools, you know, and trying to, you know, asking for advice like, hey, I've done all this stuff. Do I look good?
I have a 40 MCAT and a 4.0 and I cured cancer. Can I get into med school?
My gosh, it'll be the pre-med forum is like filled with one thread after the other of what are my chances? And I get the feeling that a lot of them are just, you know, what they're asking is, did I play the game right?
Yeah. Sometimes there does seem to be a little bit of game playing in the application. Everybody feels like they have to check off all of these specific boxes that they may have read about on studentdoctor.net.
A lot of people go through the motions of doing stuff that they think will make them good candidates without actually thinking about why those are good things to do.
Right.
Like, they don't realize that they're supposed to be cultivating a desire to help, or like maybe even like an exposure, what it means to deal with patients. Yeah. Like, a lot of people don't realize that when you're a doctor, it's not enough to be good with people. You have to be great with people, because 90% of the people you meet are like having the worst day of their lives. So like, you know, you have to be able to crack more, you know, more than a smile, maybe a joke, like get people engaged and happy, even though they're in a terrible place.
Unless you're going into pathology.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I wonder if you know, for instance, you know, I want to be a doctor, but you're not sure what kind of doctor you should be, or what, you know, maybe going through the motions will get you to that place, or it may allow you to realize, no, I don't want to be a doctor.
I think we really want people to have exposure to medicine. We want them to know what they're getting into.
Right.
And that's why we want shadowing, or, you know, some people have worked as ER scribes or worked in clinics or whatever exposure to medical environment. We want them to understand what it is they're getting into, because it's not always easy. Sometimes it's really, really hard. So that's the reason we want people to do those experiences. It's not to check a box. It's for a real practical purpose. And volunteering. We want to see people doing volunteering and altruistic work, because we want to see that they're committed to serving other people, not because it's a box to check. So those things are all important, but they're important for a reason. And I think people should keep that in mind when they're considering going to medical school.
And if you don't like all the things you're doing, maybe you should not be a doctor. I know that's the worst thing. Nobody ever wants to hear that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. There are lots of other really good career paths. You don't want to get into something that takes this much money and commitment and then find out you hate it.
Right. That's really bad. And as the three of you know, it's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle that is that is not for everyone. And Dr. B, obviously you're living the lifestyle, but it is for the right kind of person. And so, we really want to know that students understand this is a lifestyle that I need to be ready for.
That's true.
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We got some questions from some pre-meds.
Whoa. Somebody wrote to us.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
So I'm not sure I understand this question. What is the biggest soft criteria that they, I guess that's you, look for, i.e. non-GPA MCAT? I think you mentioned this already.
Altruism.
Yeah. Altruism.
Service. Caring
experience,
about other people.
Experience, right? Is that not a soft one?
You can maybe quantify that.
Yeah.
Healthcare experience, teaching.
Yeah, that's more, it is quantifiable.
Yeah.
Because 1 hour of shadowing is not healthcare experience.
Yeah.
No.
Does it matter what kind of helping is being done, or what kind of, because again, this is the question I see time and time again. Oh, I did this kind of helping, or this kind of service experience, is it good?
I like to see a pattern of service more so than specific activities.
Okay.
So if somebody's been volunteering at a nursing home for the past 5 years every week, and they call the people that they go there to see grandma and grandpa, that's a good sign that they are actually really invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily have to be medical volunteering, but something that shows service to other people is helpful. But really, it's the pattern and the commitment to it that we look for.
I want to put in my volunteerism plug right now. Something that I did before, the year before coming to medical school, I actually specifically took a year off to do AmeriCorps, but I would highly, highly recommend it to anybody. If you just want a year off to do something that's not school and you're not even planning on applying, or if you apply and like don't get in and need something to do for a year and think that a volunteer experience would be good, it's a year long. You're basically volunteering. It's a very small stipend, and they like expect you to be on food stamps. That's basically part of the pay, and then there's a little education award. But there are tons of different things that you can do, and I had a wonderful experience, and there are a lot of other people here who did AmeriCorps, and they also had really good experiences. So,
what did you do?
I was a tutor at a middle school.
Oh.
So nothing medical related. I just wanted a year that was something different that wasn't being in school, something that I would never, ever do again. I wanted to have an adventure. So I went to Washington, and I've lived in Iowa my whole life and like had my adventure year, and it was like one of the best years of my life.
Cool.
So highly recommend, do AmeriCorps. Yeah. Amera plug. It's Amera everything after that.
Research or patient care?
Yes and yes.
Yeah. I kind of thought you might say that. You can mix and match. You can do one or the other. You can. Ideally, but again, as long
ideally
as.
Ideally, some of both.
But again, as long as. Okay.
You know?
Some of both.
Yeah.
I like
yeah.
it.
There was a great gig that I ended up not pursuing as like a postgrad that I thought was really great for a future medical student. And it was a lab that does HIV research, but they had like several dedicated staff members whose entire job was, and this was in DC, it was at NIH. It was a position where like your whole job was to go into the LGBTQ community in DC and like just form connections with community leaders and members of that community and basically recruit volunteers, but not just by like going and canvassing neighborhoods, but like by actually getting to know people and like going to events and explaining to them, you know, the value of getting involved in research, how you're helping, how we can help you and things like that. And it was a great opportunity, I think, to be involved in research and to get some bench experience, but also like actually talk to patients, not in a traditional sense, but receiving a kind of care, which is getting blood draws and stuff like that.
I would still consider that medical exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like public health.
Yeah.
Work. Yeah.
So to me, you're right. That would be a really great experience to see on somebody's CV.
Yeah.
Volunteering or job shadowing?
Why all these ors?
I don't know.
You have to do everything, people. Come
this may
on.
Have come from the same person. I can't remember. But anyway.
Volunteering, yes. Job shadowing or other medical exposure, yes.
Yeah.
How?
Some people have jobs that are in clinics or hospitals, and that also gives them exposure to healthcare.
Yeah, one of my volunteer experiences was stocking shelves and occasionally talking to patients in like a surgical inpatient unit. In my college town, and it was like 3 hours a week. I'd just go in on a Sunday and plug in my headphones and push the cart around, and if anybody needed anything, you know, it was a good chance to talk to the nurses and talk to the patients and kind of see what the doctors actually do as they buzz around throughout the hallways and stuff. So there's a double experience, I think.
What about volunteering as a intern at the Short Code Podcast? No, I'm just kidding.
Yes.
How can a student with a GPA below Iowa's mean, for instance, or any school's mean?
Sure. So just so people have some information, our average science GPA for 2014's entering class was a 3.76 for science classes. So just to give people a frame of reference. What was the second part? What did you ask me?
I don't remember. so if the GPA is low.
What happens if it's too low?
Yeah.
If the science GPA is overall too low, there are post-baccalaureate programs that were created basically for this purpose. And we don't have one yet at the University of Iowa, but hopefully we will have one soon. But they're really intended for people that maybe didn't have those science grades when they were in undergrad, but this is a preparation, an intensive preparation program to get those science grades up, especially so that they can be very competitive applicants for medical school.
Do you get people who are like English majors and
yes.
that's all they've done?
No, well, they have to have done all of the science prerequisites to even apply.
Got it.
Yeah.
So that's so what you're saying is
you have
dumb
to have
question,
a strong Dave. Science background, even if you have a humanities degree. Mm-hmm.
all of our applicants that get reviewed by the committee have a strong science background.
Okay.
So they have majored in maybe English, but then they've also been on the pre-medical track wherever they went to school, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you couldn't sit for the MCAT without being on a pre-medical track.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is for your own good. Like, if you get here and you've never done science before,
it's going to suck.
It's going to be a rush.
No, don't, no.
It's going to be a rough roller coaster ride. Yeah.
What are some basic tips to prepare for interview day?
I think it's good to practice. So if you are at a college that has a career center and they have some preparation that you can do, always a great idea to prepare. I used to work in a career center, so that's why it's near and dear to my heart. So preparing, anticipating what kinds of questions might come your way, as you would if you were going to any kind of job or internship interview, thinking about, okay, what might they ask me? And thinking about what you might want to say. If somebody asks you, why are you interested in this? And things like that. I do like to tell people that you want to think about your first impression. And so dressing professionally is a good idea. It's not something that we require. But at the same time, if you walk into a room and there's 15 other people all dressed up and you're not, sometimes you can feel a little bit out of place.
Oh, so that you're... It's more about confidence, really.
And some of our interviewers also like to see that you've really taken the time and the effort to put your best foot forward that day. And that includes dressing up professionally.
Cut the vent of your sport coat or your suit coat, gentlemen.
That's good advice.
I've
not just for medical school.
I think so. You know, in the back where there's the split at the bottom hem of your jacket. Well, those usually come tied
lightly stitched.
There's
together.
A thread. Yeah. That's
why
usually,
do they do that?
I don't know. Just,
do they do just to give pockets
just to
why
give
do
just
that?
To give young men the opportunity to look like idiots. I think it's pretty clear that's the reason.
Oh, wait, I have a suggestion.
Yeah.
Oh, how do you feel about getting calls? Like, how do you feel about feeling calls from people who want to check in about their application?
Sure. I think that our office, I'll just speak for our office, we are absolutely open to calls and emails. And I would way rather get a call from a student and tell them the right thing than have them go on that dirty little website and try to find an answer that has been given by someone who isn't qualified to give the answer. So we are fine with calling emailing us anytime.
This is one of the questions, is how long between interview day and receiving word, how long does that usually take?
An eternity and a half.
This is a question, and again, one of those things that pops up constantly and says,
it's been variable, right? Absolutely.
Quite variable.
Yes.
So I don't think
among us
could,
or among schools?
Among us.
Oh, okay.
I don't think we could commit to a timeline.
No. We say to applicants who come for an interview, the earliest you could hear back is about 6 weeks after your interview, but you might not find anything out for several months.
That's going to be hard.
Yes. I remember those days. It's
brutal.
It's stressful.
That's right. And it's nice that you guys are aware of that and you're honest about that.
I mean,
that.
You're not doing it on purpose. You're
not testing
people to destruction. Although, you know, that might be an interesting part of the interview process, like how many times they called.
No.
Okay. Sorry.
As an admissions committee member, I can tell you we do not get notified about how many phone calls were made.
They specifically avoid phone calls and such things, which is part of why Dr. B is the secret Dr. B.
Yes. That's right.
Do you, how often do candidates apply a second time? And is that a problem?
Not at all. I would say... I don't really have a firm number, but I would say at least a quarter of our incoming class every year has applied more than one time. Mm-hmm. So that might mean two or three times. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely not something to be embarrassed about or to be discouraged about. Obviously, it would be only natural to feel discouraged.
You've only got so many spots. I mean, you might.
Right. And at the same time, our admission staff is available to meet with students who were denied admission. I know not every school is willing to do that, but we will do that and help coach a student reapply in a successful way. So we can offer that.
The thing that's really tough about the med school application process is that the next cycle starts as soon as the last one begins or ends, right. rather.
Yes.
And so what happens to a lot of people is that they get caught in this like back-to-back application cycle, and you basically have to anticipate that you're not going to get in like halfway through the current cycle and start doing stuff to enhance your application for the next cycle. So it takes a little bit of strategy.
Is all hope lost if one receives a low MCAT score the first time around?
That's a good question, though. How do you look at taking them more than once, and like how does that play out?
It's fine to take it more than once. We usually would expect to see that oftentimes there's some class work needed in between times as well. We've seen people who have taken it and then taken it again in like 3 or 4 weeks.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Ouch.
And get the same score?
Sometimes, and sometimes not. Sometimes higher, sometimes lower. And that's a little maybe less impressive than showing that you've actually worked to learn the information.
Because the...
I don't know why a score would change significantly in 3 weeks.
Okay, fair enough. That makes sense. Is it a good idea, do you think, to take a year off? I mean, this may be more of a...
Yes.
Who said that?
This may be more of a... less of an admissions committee question and more of just a life question. You think it's better to take a year off, a year or more off after undergrad to sort of develop some life skills before applying?
I think it's really important that people are able to have a certain level of maturity before they come into literally dealing with life and death situations. So if they need a year or two of life experience to gain that maturity, then yes, I do think it's a good idea.
That would require a degree of maturity to even make that decision, but
exactly.
Yeah.
But not everybody needs to do that. We have a lot of people who come straight from undergrad and are terrific medical students and become terrific doctors.
Had I applied, I would probably have benefited from taking 20 years off before.
Could either of you imagine what it would have been like to just start medical school straight away after undergrad?
You can go first.
I was so not ready. I'd never lived on my own because I went to school in my hometown, which, you know, was on the East Coast. I lived at home. I took some time. I explored other careers. I think maybe that's something that can be reflected well, and you guys can speak to this, but it reflects well on an application if you say, like, well, I didn't just wake up one day and decide I want to do medicine. I tried other things, and I just wasn't happy. And I really think this is the only thing that I can do well and that will make me happy and really benefit people. Yeah, I was not ready. I would have crashed and burned. I don't mind saying that.
I think I would have been fine grades-wise. I think I would have been a high mental health risk. I'm going to be perfectly honest about that. Taking my year off was a really good chance to explore the world, to reaffirm that this is what I wanted to do, but also to learn to relax. I've never been able to relax for years and years. And I think that is a really common thing with medical students, like compulsive studying and like really high anxiety. And
I hadn't noticed.
Oh, shush.
I'm talking about you.
But I mean, really, I think I would have been at a much higher risk for burning out and for having a lot of like anxiety and depression problems because I just didn't know how to relax and live my life at all. Like I did a lot of other stuff and I, you know, but to just be able to like sit at home and watch TV and have that be okay. And I don't have to also be studying every single time I'm around my friends. Like I would always like go to movie nights with friends and the friends would watch the movie and I would sit there and study. And like that counted as my social time.
And that and your AmeriCorps thing sort of combine and turn into.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Sort of a chance to think about something other than.
Yeah. And then I wanted.
Just getting those awesome grades and like studying and like making yourself crazy.
Oh yeah. No, I was a grade prick. I was well above the grade average. and it, I don't think necessarily made me that much better of a student. As much as taking a year off did. And that being said, some people can come in and be great and have a great time, but like it, you know, this is one of your only chances to just go out and do something that you'll never do again.
There's no year off after you graduate.
There's no,
I mean, you've got $250,000 of debt. If you're an out-of-state student, like, you need to get to work. You need to save your pennies, pay your interest.
But if you go before, you know, do what you want. Get some travel, get some volunteering, yeah. Get some just things that you won't ever do again while you're young.
Yeah. Like, you can still do those in small doses, I think, like, after you graduate. But I think you're right. Like, you will very likely not have that opportunity again until you retire.
I would suspect. Do you do any work outside of your work now, Dr. B?
Work outside of my
like
work?
Service type stuff these days?
I do. That is somewhat related to my job, but yes.
Okay. I mean, I would suspect that having that experience early also kind of opens that door for later in life. I mean, you might not be able to do it during your residency, but
no, the service that I do now is very specifically related to the work that I do.
Sure.
And it involves my patients.
Okay.
But it's still really fun.
Yeah. Well, late bloomers. What do you think of late bloomers? So we have, we'll call her Janie. She's a 26-year-old veteran, a couple of years out of her military year. Currently has no post-high school education. She's been working in a psych facility and has got a plan to go to community college and to a four-year college. And she's decided that she wants to be a doctor. What would your first bit of advice be?
Get good grades.
Yeah.
I was also a late bloomer. I did go to college right after high school, but I didn't go to med school right after college. Mm-hmm. So I took about 5 years before I decided to go to med school. So,
not an uncommon situation.
No,
but I think for Janie, I mean, she really has no post high school. You know, she was in the military for her. She had a career in the military, and then she's 2.5 years out after her military career, and she's decided to.
Have a lot of people who, not a lot, but a significant number of people who were in the military who apply for med school, and not all of them went straight to college. A lot of them have done that after their military service. But a lot of the people who have been in the military have worked as medics or have exposure in a professional environment and really end up being great medical students. So she still needs to be able to accomplish the good grades, get the scores on the MCATs, get the scores that she needs to be able to even apply. But yeah, military service is certainly, I think, an advantage. It does give you that maturity.
Well, I was going to say, is this one of the schools where you don't actually technically have to have a bachelor's degree? You just have to have the science classes?
There are some
schools like that.
Yeah, you do need a bachelor's degree.
Okay. I can't recall ever hearing of anyone that came here without a bachelor's.
You have to have one.
I think it's very some schools think it's very technically you don't. So, so you could do it in 3 years or something if she's really in a hurry. But I don't know. I would say remember that if you really enjoyed the military and that's something that you'd be okay doing more of, there are lots of military scholarship programs too.
I left out the fact that she's got a lot of GI Bill stuff to take advantage of.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure. I'm just saying there are other military programs that'll put you through medical school and stuff. I don't know how much GI Bill pays for various things.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know the ins and outs of the military at all. I'm just saying there's more.
I think there's a lot of saluting. That's what I've heard. There's a lot of saluting in the military. That's what I know.
That's true.
They wear uniforms.
Yeah.
I think if you're in the military, they will maybe pay for medical school. But I don't know the details of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Good luck to Janie.
Yeah. I just wanted to piggyback on a comment that a topic we were just talking about, not needing a medical degree. I think for the dental school here, you don't necessarily need a bachelor's degree.
Okay.
Because I do know of someone who's in the dental school and just did 2 years of science and math and English and all that, but didn't get a full college degree.
I would also say don't give up on something or don't rule out something like counseling, like being a psychologist instead of a psychiatrist or something. So if you've already been working in that field, you know, maybe that's something that you're interested in, or you could be some sort of med tech or something that doesn't, if you get into school and you're like, I cannot do 10 more years of this or whatever, you know? I don't know, just don't rule out those fields. There
are other options, really good options.
Good and important and all have to do with healthcare. So.
And another thing too, just to add, we admitted somebody, and we typically do each year, in their 40s. We definitely have students that join us much later in life, and that's just fine.
Wow, cool.
That's awesome.
Dr. B, Amy yes. Hearn, I want to thank you for joining us on the show today.
Anytime.
Thank you very, very much.
It was really great Cheers. Talking to you. Stay tuned after the credits. We'll have our weird disease of the week. If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. So give us a, you know, blah, blah. We'd like to hear from you. I can't even have Corey edit that out because there's music over it. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea for us, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. Thank you for your questions this week. And the show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and the Writing and Humanities program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in a week.
This week's weird disease is flail chest. That's right, flail like a weapon, or like you're flailing around. It is actually.
I think I might have that. Anyway,
go ahead. I'm pretty sure you don't. It is a life-threatening medical condition. Oh. And so basically what happens is you break at least a couple of ribs. There are a couple different criteria for it, but you break some ribs and they detach from your chest wall. So it's kind of like flailing as you breathe in and out, I mm-hmm. think is where the name comes from.
I don't like the sound of this at all.
Yeah, no, I don't think people like having it either. It's presumably kind of painful, but yeah, flail chest. All Keep right. your ribs in place.
Thank you.